empathised with him. We need to get him out of his comfort zone.
How do you suggest doing that? Said Isak-san.
Show him the posts. Tell him his wife spewed her guts online and we know exactly what's been going on behind closed doors. He gave one of his nods. His lips were tight, his eyes tired.
All right, got that, Silk, he said. And Frost?
He added as an afterthought. Actually, I said, I was wondering if I could go in there this time. Alone. Chapter 115. Silk looked decidedly pissed off. I had his number. The guy was an ambitious suck-up who didn't want the likes of me stepping on his shiny tan brogues. He needn't have worried.
I'm sorry, you can't go in there by yourself. It's against protocol, said Isak-san.
His mouth a thin line. His face had a déjà vu look. We'd had this conversation before. He and I both wanted to find Harper's wife and ideally squeeze a confession out of Harper, but the difference was Isak-san wasn't prepared to bend the rules to do it. As for me, I've never been overly fussed about the how. All I care about is getting the job done. Act first, apologise after. I realise it's not standard procedure.
I said no, Mackenzie.
I wasn't interested in a big dick contest. I needed to army-proof this one for him. I can get to him.
I disagree. You think just because Harper has been obsessing over you, he's going to roll over as soon as you bat your eyelashes at him. But that actually makes you the very worst person to go in there.
I'm not basing it on that at all. And for the record, I don't think he has been obsessing, as you put it. Those articles and photos you found were background research, not a stalker's cache.
So what are you basing it on, then?
He looked surprised. Doesn't just hate having his orders questioned, I thought. He doesn't like to get it wrong, either. I've got to do it, because I look like his wife. She says so herself, right here. I flicked through the forum printouts. That Scotland Yard woman she talks about is me.
Let me see that.
He reached a hand out for the page and read aloud.
I kept telling myself I was overreacting about my husband's interest in the slasher, even when I found all those printouts about that Scotland Yard woman who looks just like the other victims, and just like me too.
Hmm, he said, riffling through a separate file, pulling out a photo a moment later.
It's the picture of Sarah Harper, we circulated with the All Ports warning.
He handed it to me.
I hadn't really noticed it before, but it's true, you do look a lot like her.
I passed it round.
She doesn't just look like Mackenzie, said Big Daddy, ripping open a Snickers bar, king size. The wife's right. There's a definite resemblance to Pejman and Abian, too.
That not only means Dan Harper has a type, I said as Big D masticated loudly in my ear, it also backs up the theory the victims were stand-ins for his wife. Which brings us back to the original questions. Where is she, and what's he done with her? Chapter 116. Interview Room 3, Scotland Yard, 1523. I peered through the spy hole. It had taken some arm twisting, but Isak-san had given way in the end.
If I paid you, you come straight out. Understood? He'd said.
Copy, I'd said, with a one-finger salute. Possibly not the best response, given his attitude to army types. I knocked on the interview room door. Dan Harper had been interrogated for hours. Showing him respect was key, a way to create trust and build a bond, which in turn would make him more likely to talk. Hello, Dan, I said, going in all casual, deliberately using his first name. Interview tips for dummies.
Ziba.
He sounded pleased to see me, almost like he'd been waiting for me to show up. Mind if we have a chat? I said, sitting down as if we were shooting the breeze down the local rather than holed up in an interview suite. Put him in control, I thought. Then yank away the mat.
Do I have a choice?
Not, I didn't do it.
Interesting.
I made to get up.
You don't have to talk to me. I just thought maybe you'd prefer to. I had to pull some strings to speak to you. My DI's only given me 5 minutes, then I'm out. He's a piece of work, if you must know, I said, rolling my eyes. Share a confidence. Build a bridge. Silk's the hot shot round here.
My enemy's enemy is my friend. I was channeling Coleridge, putting the right words in the best order. Everything I said mattered.
No, wait, we can talk.
Good, I said, sitting back down and making a show of looking at my watch. Putting a time limit on things always works, upping the ante and all that. Plus, Harper knew me, which meant he'd rather I interviewed him than Silk and Frost. And given how much I looked like his wife and the two murder victims, he'd subconsciously think he could overpower me, just like he'd overpowered them. I fired my first shot, a bullet out of the dark. No build-up, so his reaction would be easier to gauge.
Who's Noah? I said.
Chapter 117. Harper went red. His eyes watered, his hands trembled, and although he didn't answer, his mouth dropped open. The cues were easy to read, but they weren't what I was expecting. Noah's name had provoked a reaction, but it wasn't anger. It was intense sadness. More is revealed when a subject's reactions deviate from what you would expect than at any other time. Effective interrogation. Detecting deception by ex-Special Agent Martin Carroll. I remembered the passage well. The books on my living room shelf, great chunks highlighted in fluorescent pen, the margins annotated so much they obscure part of the text. But if Harper's wife had been having it off with Noah, why would sadness be his dominant emotion? Surely he'd be furious. I thought back to what she'd written. The terrible guilt she felt and her difficulty sleeping. Her block about sex. The feel of his skin on hers. And how whatever happened with Noah had tipped her into a pit of despair. We'd all interpreted the posts in the same way. Fact is, we'd been so focused on the emasculation element and Harper's affair with Pejman, we'd assumed his wife had been unfaithful too. But as my old CO used to say, when you assume anything, you make an ass out of you and me. I, of all people, should have seen it. I should have read between the lines, because what if we'd got it wrong? What if Noah wasn't Sarah Harper's lover at all? What if he was actually her child? Noah was your son, wasn't he? Harper looked down at his hands, swallowing hard. He died, I said in a softer voice, putting it together. It was a horrible accident. Harper's jaw clenched. He balled his hand into a fist. Here was the anger that was missing before, but why? I thought back to what I'd read in the forum posts. The whole thing's my fault. The sand settled. You blame your wife for Noah's death, don't you? He jerked his chin up, as if about to fight, then slumped forward again, defeated.
She's not well, he said, his voice a whisper.
He was making excuses for her, but that's not to say he didn't hold her responsible for what had happened, or hate her for it. I thought back to the killer's signature, the way he ripped out his victim's wombs, and how the womb is a potent symbol of motherhood. Then I looked at Harper. At last, the gruesome act made sense. Chapter 118. I still didn't know exactly what had happened to Noah, but whatever it was made Dan Harper think his wife was an unfit mother. And if Pejman and Abian were stand-ins for his rage, it would make a twisted sort of sense for him to attack their wombs. Signatures always mean something. Understand a killer's work, and you understand the killer. Harper's signature was his way of saying his wife didn't deserve to bear children. The domestic abuse she alluded to wasn't enough to sate his anger, Only murder would soothe him until he felt the compulsion to strike again.
She's not well.
Is that what he told himself? Is that why he felt unable to attack her directly? The balled-up fist showed he wanted to lash out, but had her vulnerability kept him from going after her, despite what else he'd done to her? And was what I'd thought before right? Was the affair with Pejman, who bore such a striking resemblance to his wife, about revenge and domination rather than desire? Did it start off as a way of dealing with his violent urges? Very 50 Shades, her sister had said. But did that stop being enough for him? Did he literally substitute his penis for his knife? And is that why there wasn't any ejaculate at the scene? Because the thing with Pejman was never about sex, it was always about the rage he felt towards his wife, which is why the sex itself was always violent, even if Pejman told her sister she liked it. I took my own advice. I had to empathize with Harper, put the blame onto the victims. Give him a way to save face.
It must have been tough, losing Noah like that, and your wife going off the rails.
I was winging it, making out I knew more than I did, just like I had with Craig Bowden earlier.
It wasn't her fault. She's not well.
That old nut again. He leaned forward, gripping the edge of the table so tight the tips of his fingers turned white.
You've got to let me go, Ziba. I didn't do this, and while I'm locked up in here, my wife could be anywhere. With anyone,
he said, his voice dropping on the last words, his eyes wide and desperate. The guy really knows how to work a room, I thought. Using my name like that was a nice touch, so were the dramatics. He almost had me buying it. You're only human, I said, as if I hadn't heard him. Your wife might be unwell, but that doesn't mean she didn't make your life a nightmare. He shook his head.
She's been trying to get help. Seeing a psychiatrist, Dr. Floyd, works in Harley Street.
That doesn't mean she's not to blame for what happened to Noah. He was your son. How can you get past that?
She wasn't responsible for her actions.
Very legalistic. He'd obviously thought this through. A court of law's one thing, but that doesn't mean it's easy for you to forgive her.
Please let me go. I need to find her before...
Before we do? I said, finishing the sentence for him.
Before it's too late,
he said, his voice barely audible. He pinched his sinuses and took a deep breath, reining himself in.
She doesn't know what she's doing. Her actions are beyond her control.
Another legal expression. I finally got it. Dan Harper wasn't trying to convince me he didn't blame his wife for what had happened. He was trying to persuade me not to blame her. Which meant he didn't hate her at all. Instead, he was trying to protect her. Chapter 119. Major Incident Room, Scotland Yard, 1556. I was back in the incident room going over the data. Why was Harper going to such lengths to defend his wife? Something didn't scan. I'd got it wrong about Sarah having an affair. What else had I missed? I'd checked the birth registry. The Harpers had had a son called Noah who died recently, aged just 6 months. COD was accidental suffocation. The sort of trauma that could easily be a pre-kill stressor, I thought, as I called the pathologist who'd carried out the autopsy. I remember the case well, he said. A child had been sharing a bed with his mother, an afternoon nap. They'd fallen asleep together and she'd rolled on top of him. By the time she woke up, he'd stopped breathing. The father came home from work early, found them and called it in. Paramedics performed CPR and took him to the Royal Free, but he was DOA. Dead on arrival. Suddenly, Harper's wife's drinking and self-loathing made a lot more sense. Not to mention the guilt about going to sleep.
It was a really horrible accident, said the pathologist. The mother was devastated, as you'd expect. She was already suffering from extreme postpartum depression.
Was that another thing that made Harper think she was an unfit mother? The fact that she wasn't going all Sound of Music on him?
Here you go, said the office manager, dropping a file of crime scene photos on my desk after I'd put the phone down. I took the file over to the table by the incident board, where there was more room, and spread out the snaps. COD in both homicides was asphyxiation and exsanguination, suffocation and blood loss. Maybe the suffocation was a link to what had happened to Noah, but even so, the combination with that and stabbing was strange. The MOs were completely different. They appealed to different offender typologies. In many ways, they were at odds with each other. But that's not all that struck me. The crimes weren't about sex, but all the same, there should have been ejaculate at the scenes. Both murders were anger retaliation homicides. In these types of crimes, the offender picks his victims because something about them reminds him of the true source of his rage, which makes them symbols of the person he really wants to destroy. Take the Florida serial killer Bobby Joe Long. He sexually assaulted and murdered at least 10 women in the Tampa Bay area during an 8-month spree. But the true source of his rage was his mother, and he targeted his victims because they reminded him of her. Our perp definitely fitted into this category. But something was missing. Anger retaliation homicides always involve a strong sexual element, as well as overkill. The offender either rapes his victim, blows his load, or takes a trophy. So why had he done none of those things here? Chapter 120. Impotence wasn't the answer. Even if the perp was serving boneless pork, he'd still be able to achieve orgasm through masturbation, as I'd already explained to the delightful Ruddock, which meant we should have found ejaculate at the scene or signs he'd taken a souvenir. And Harper wasn't impotent. Yasmin's sexts proved that. I leaned back in my chair, the crime scene pictures spread out in front of me, close-ups of the grisly horrors the killer had unleashed. When I'd presented the initial profile to the team on Wednesday, I'd said the offender got his thrills by stabbing his victims, penetrating them with a blade rather than his penis. Now my brain was running on a different track. There were sexual elements at the scene. The way the bodies had been posed, the lacerations to the breasts, even the assault on the womb. But what if this had nothing to do with sex? What would that mean then? I got up and walked over to the incident board, which was covered in marker pen, post-its, and photos. I looked at the pictures the forensic photographer had taken this morning of the Harper's living room. The overturned chair, smashed glass, and bloody hand mark on the arm of the sofa. I looked at the photo of Harper's wife now pinned up with the others, a full-length shot. And I looked at the quotes from the forum post someone had taken it upon themselves to write out. Silk, I guessed. The perfectly formed letters matched his waistcoat and pocket square look. Then I thought of Dan Harper, sitting in the interview room saying over and over that what happened to Noah wasn't his wife's fault and that she wasn't well. I thought about what the pathologist had told me, that Harper's wife had had extreme postpartum depression and was devastated by her son's death, and how I'd figured that could be a pre-kill stressor. A shiver ran down my back as I put it together. Statistically, most serial killers are men, especially in anger retaliation homicides. But what if this offender was different? What if he was actually a she? Chapter 121. I scratched the base of my skull with the end of my pen, thinking it through. It's taken criminologists decades to accept that not every female fits the gender stereotype, that we're not all Mary Poppins at heart. Shame they couldn't have sat down with me for 5 minutes. I could have saved them a whole lot of time and trouble.
But even the big shots in the FBI have been clinging to the fantasy for way too long. Less than 10 years ago, Roy Hazelwood, a highly respected profiler with the Bureau, argued that women serial killers didn't exist. His line was, in the rare instances when they did commit a string of signature homicides, they had to have been manipulated by a dominant male, Rosemary West being a case in point. Thankfully, that mantra has since been binned. It's true that serial killers usually are male. Less than 10% of people who carry out signature homicides have 2X chromosomes. However, it's now recognized that women can commit heinous acts too. They can murder. They can be serial killers. And significantly, most of them act without a partner. But that doesn't mean they're fired in the same kiln as the men. Although women can be just as lethal, there are key differences between the sexes when it comes to serial killing. I went back to my desk and pulled up an online article from the Journal of Forensic Criminology to check my facts. Not long ago, a German research group carried out a study of female serial killers. From what I remembered, their results had included a section on how women typically murdered their victims. I scrolled through the piece until I found what I was looking for. The victims were frequently under the influence of drink or drugs at the time of the attacks, and they died mainly due to knife violence. Just like Pejman and Abian, I thought. Though that didn't prove anything about the perp's gender, it makes sense for offenders to choose high-risk targets, and knife homicides are less rare here than in the States, given UK gun laws. I carried on. Women are most likely to poison or suffocate their victims to render them incapacitated. Arvix hadn't been poisoned, but both of them had been asphyxiated. Tick two. Deadly attacks by females tend to be in areas well known to the perpetrator, whereas attacks by males generally take place away from their area of residence, at work, or public environments like a bar. Both victims had been murdered in secluded locations in Primrose Hill, and when I'd first presented the profile, I'd said the offender was a local, someone familiar with the area. 3 out of 3. Females who commit serial homicides are more likely to suffer from a severe mental disorder than men. The nature of the homicides, the extreme overkill and level of degradation, did suggest an offender with mental health issues. It was the last point that really made me sit up, though. Female serial killers are often attempting to eradicate a part of themselves that they hate. I thought of the victims and who they might represent. I thought of the uniqueness of the signature. And I thought of what I'd read in the forum posts, as well as earlier on the train. It all added up. CFB. Clear as a fucking bell. Dan Harper's wife wasn't a victim. She was the killer. Chapter 122. His wife, Isakson said, looking at me like I was a moon chicken.
What makes you think that? It's all there in black and white. She was terrified of Harper. She was convinced he was the slasher.
I know.
You've really lost me now.
It's classic smoke and mirrors, I said. She fits the profile to a T, but we missed it because she kept saying her husband was after her.
You think she was framing her husband?
She wasn't framing him. You've read those posts. The woman was all over the place. Harper said much the same thing. She wouldn't have had the wherewithal to pull off something like that.
So what are you saying then?
I'm saying she killed Pejman and Abian. She just didn't know she did. Isakson rubbed his eyes. This was the second time I'd told him he'd got the wrong guy in the traps. Let's take it back to the profile. I said the crimes were about the need to dominate, that the offender's usual coping mechanisms weren't working for him anymore, and that he craved control because his life was spiraling away from him.
Right,
said Isakson, glancing at his watch. The hands on the custody clock weren't standing still. Harper's wife's been suffering from postnatal depression. She blames herself for the death of her son, and now she's found out Harper's cheating on her. Her life's screwing up big time. And her usual ways of dealing with stress, binging and drinking, aren't working for her. She hates what she's become and longs to be back in control of her life.
And you know this because...
She says so herself. She hated her body's natural urges. Despite the frequent forum posting, she was obviously withdrawn, like I profiled the offender.
But that's Harper's fault. He socially isolated her.
Maybe. He definitely had a thing against the people she used to hang out with, but there's nothing in here to suggest he tried to stop her going out and making new friends. More likely, she's a loner because she lacks confidence to mix with other people. Which, by the way, fits with the eating disorder profile. Bulimics and anorexics tend to be riddled with insecurity. It's what gets them sticking their fingers down their throats in the first place. Isakson pursed his lips. He was more PC than me. It's often a form of self-loathing, too, I said. She felt abused by Harper, but she didn't hate him. The person she really hates is herself. It comes through in everything she says. I'm not a couch doctor, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's what her nightmares were about. It's not her husband chasing her. It's her demons, and the only way she can get rid of them is by killing the part of herself she blames for everything that's gone wrong in her life. The DI's face cleared. He was beginning to get where I was going with this. Lily Abian and Yasmin Pejman were surrogates, like we thought. What we got wrong is who they represent. They symbolize her. The person she wants to destroy is herself. The eating disorder and alcoholism are about that too. She's literally trying to self-destruct.
You said she had to kill the part of herself she blamed for her life going south. What's that about?
She thinks she was a terrible mother. In her mind, she killed her son, and from what we know about the timing of Harper's affair with Pejman, she possibly blames her postnatal depression for her husband's cheating. That's why she cut out the victim's wombs. She blamed all her woes on motherhood. She must have found a photo of Pejman, judging by what she wrote. That was the secondary trigger. Pejman didn't just look like her, she was another reason everything was turning to crap.
And Abian?
I shrugged. This bit was just a guess. The woman's an addict, and addicts are often obsessive compulsives. From what she says, she tried to keep tabs on Harper, going through his possessions, that sort of thing. Abian looked like her, just like Pejman did. If she saw Harper with her, it would have been enough to set her off a second time. She was on a roll by then, addicted to the kill, even though her conscious mind didn't know it. Cutting her victim's breasts and posing them the way she did was about dominating them sexually. In her mind, they'd cuckolded her, or whatever the female equivalent is. She was taking the power back from them. The asphyxiation's different, though. That's about her. She suffocated her baby and likely feels she should have died in his place. It should have been her who was smothered, not him. In the moment she was killing them, she became Pejman and Abian. When she smothered them, she was smothering herself. I stopped to catch my breath. As usual, I'd been speaking too fast. Isakson was stroking his chin. He might not be buying it, but at least he wasn't rejecting it. It all fits, look, I said, pointing to the photo of Sarah up on the incident board. She even matches the physical part of the profile, late 20s, small and slight. I can't see how the woman thought she was fat, there's not an ounce on her. The DI sucked air through his teeth.
And Pejman and Abian may well have recognized her, which is why they accepted a ride, he said. And if not, she'd hardly have seemed threatening.
He rubbed his temples with his thumb and middle finger.
There's one thing you still haven't answered. She was convinced she was about to become the slasher's next victim. So how can she actually be the killer?
Now that's where it gets really interesting. Chapter 123. Have you heard of dissociative fugues?
I beg your pardon?
The moon chicken look was back. It's a mental disorder, a sort of breakdown, An amnesic episode, where you temporarily lose your identity and occasionally take on a new persona, I said, making an effort to talk slowly. The sufferer loses touch with reality. They have no idea who they really are.
Never heard of it. How long does it last?
Depends. It can vary from hours to weeks, months even sometimes. What's interesting is no one can tell when you're having one. You come across as completely normal to other people and can even engage in complex social interaction, arguments, discussions, that sort of thing. While it's going on, the only hint something's not right is mild confusion, which most people wouldn't even notice.
And afterwards, he said.
You might feel depression or shame, just like Harper's wife describes, but there's no memory of the fugue itself or what you've done when you've been under. I was talking fast, despite myself. I took a breath and tried again. Sufferers talk about blackouts and being out of it, again like Sarah Harper. And as you can imagine, not being able to remember chunks of time can be pretty upsetting, frightening even, which also fits with what she says in her forum posts. Isaacson inhaled deeply. This was a guy who dealt in forensic certainties and physical evidence. He doesn't like things he can't quantify, I thought.
So what causes these fugue states?
From what I've read, they're about trauma, the mind trying to escape what it's terrified of. But at some point, the sufferer has to face up to their fears. Their minds won't let them run forever. They're very rare, I added. Apparently they affect less than 0.2% of the population.
So around 126 cases in the UK,
he said, whip quick. All I know is your maths is better than mine. Isaacson tapped his lips with his forefinger. His face was as impassive as ever, but that didn't mean he wasn't taking it all in.
So fugues are brought on by trauma?
These kinds of psychological conditions always have triggers. Severe stress could definitely be one, especially the sudden death of a child, and if there's a predisposition, heavy drinking can aggravate it.
You think this has happened to her before?
Maybe. I flipped through the forum posts till I found what I was looking for. Listen to this. An honest-to-goodness flashback, like after what happened with GC. And here. His parents were just like mine. I mean, he didn't have anyone like GC to deal with, but his folks were every bit as cold and hard to please. With him, it was more his dad than his mom, but he still knows what rejection tastes like. He knows how it dulls the colour of everything. That fits with the profile too, I said, a childhood characterised by maternal neglect. Isaacson fanned his fingers in and out over his chin.
What makes you so sure Harper's not playing us? He's a clever guy. This could be a ruse. We've only got the posts and his word for it that things weren't right with his wife.
Only a shrink can make that call when we bring her in, but she fits the profile and the fugue states would explain a lot. He gave me a squinty look.
How do you know so much about all this?
Because Sarah Harper isn't the only one with dissociative fugues. Chapter 124.
Are you trying to tell me you have amnesic episodes?
No, I am not.
So who are you talking about then?
Two desks away, Ruddock was hanging over Frost, giving her reason to lodge a harassment complaint. Shame he can't forget who he is for a bit, I thought. Give us all a damn break. You ever hear the story of Agatha Christie going missing? I said to Isaacson.
I'm sorry?
In 1926, she disappeared after a row with her husband. Drove her car down to Surrey and wasn't heard of again for 11 days. Vanished without a trace. Police thought she'd drowned. They dredged the lake where her car was found and launched a massive manhunt. More than 15,000 people came out to look for her. They used biplanes, bloodhounds, the works. It was big news. Arthur Conan Doyle and Dorothy L. Sayers even got involved. Then she was found. Turns out she'd checked herself into some spa in Harrogate, the Old Swan. But she'd assumed a completely new identity, claimed her name was Teresa Neal, and she was a bereaved mother from Cape Town. When her husband turned up, she's supposed to have said, "Well, fancy that. My brother's just arrived."
Isakson raised an eyebrow.
"Sounds like a publicity stunt to me."
"No one knows for sure," I said. "She never talked about it afterwards. I'm reading a book about it at the moment, actually. One of the theories is she was suffering from a dissociative fugue. It's certainly what her doctors seemed to think at the time."
I slowed down. I was gabbling again. Her husband had just told her he was in love with someone else. It's possible the episode was brought on by shock, a way of dealing with a painful situation by detaching herself from reality.
Isakson sucked his lips.
"If Sarah Harper did kill Pejman and Abian during a fugue state, that'd explain the absence of hesitation marks on the body," he said. "It also explains why she doesn't remember what she did."
"But it doesn't explain Dan Harper's behaviour," I said, cutting in. "She may not have known what she did, but I think he does. The newspaper clippings, the obsession with me, the fact he seems to have been following her, they all point to the same thing. Harper knew his wife killed Pejman and Abian. And this whole time, he's been doing everything he could to protect her and stop the truth from coming out."
Chapter 125. Ditch the filters, we were told at the beginning of our special forces training. Preconceived ideas won't just blind you, they could end up killing you, and they could blow your mission too, which is even worse. There had been a few laughs, but the instructor's face didn't twitch. A bit like the DI, I thought, glancing at Isakson, who was looking at me with his usual fixed expression.
"Protect her," he said, tugging at his earlobe. "Where'd you get that? He might not be our killer, but it doesn't sound like he was exactly sunshine and roses with his missus."
"There's two sides to every story," I said. "Society conditions us to see the female as the submissive in a relationship, but the game isn't always played like that. I think something else might have been going on."
"So now you're saying the wife's the dominant partner?"
"No, I'm saying things may not have gone down the way we think they did. Sarah sees herself as a victim, and so she interprets Harper's behaviour as aggressive, but there might be another way to read it."
"That business with the bath sounds pretty aggressive to me."
"Aye, it sounds that way," I said, "but I think Harper might explain it differently."
"What makes you so sure you're going to get him to talk? We've hardly got two words out of him since he got here."
"I don't need him to talk."
"I'm too tired for riddles, Mackenzie."
"I just need him to listen. His face'll tell me what I want to know," I said, thinking of my chat with Calder in the canteen yesterday. Was it really only a day ago? It felt a decade had passed since then. Isakson pursed his lips, a quick squeeze and release. Looked like he was blowing me a kiss.
I'd like to see that, I thought. The guy's more uptight than a suicide bomber holding in a fart. "I'm not happy about you going in there alone. Perhaps you should take Silk," he said, folding his arms.
That was the last thing I wanted to do. "Give me 10 minutes with him, then you can send in whoever you want." He scratched the back of his neck.
"This is a waste of time, Mackenzie. It doesn't matter at this stage whether Harper was or wasn't abusing his wife. What matters is that we find this woman fast."
"That's exactly what I plan to do. Not least because she might be about to kill again."
Chapter 126. Interview Room 3, Scotland Yard, 1736. I'd been so sure before that Dan Harper was trying to manipulate me, I hadn't paid attention to what he was saying. But now I knew Sarah was behind the homicides, his words took on new meaning.
"My wife could be anywhere, with anyone."
He hadn't been scared she was with a murderer. He was terrified she was with her next victim. I'd finished his next sentence wrong, too. It wasn't, "Please let me go, I need to find her before we do." It was before she kills again. And his desperation told me something else.
Dan Harper might be our best chance of bringing Sarah in. I knocked again before going into the interview room. Can I get you a drink, Dan, or a bite to eat? The coffee's pretty minging, but I could grab you a soda, and probably rustle up a packet of Walkers if you fancy it. Hello, good cop.
I'm fine, thanks, he said, wetting his lips.
He was thirsty. He wanted to say yes, but something was stopping him. My guess was, being a lawyer, he was on to our tricks. Silk and Frost had questioned him for hours, and yet he hadn't told them anything. He's smart, I thought. Keeps it together under pressure. Whatever she may have thought, and however his behaviour came across, Harper loved his wife. Even now he was doing everything he could to shield her, even if it meant taking the fall for her crime. But I was about to put a bullet in that plan. I took my time sitting down and made a big deal of opening the file containing the forum posts and flicking through them. I wanted to let Harper know I had everything I needed, that it didn't matter to me whether he talked or not. Sometimes in an interview, when the subject thinks they've got nothing to lose by confessing, they suddenly get all chatty. Often it's a relief to finally cast off the secret they've been lugging around. Dan Harper didn't strike me as that sort, but I figured there was no harm in trying. I watched him out of the corner of my eye as I laid the file flat on the table so he could see what I was looking at. Definitely curious, I thought. And worried, too. He doesn't know about these. Good. Gives me scope to get creative. Sarah has an alcohol problem, I said, using her first name as if we were old friends. She talks about it here. Did you know she was a regular contributor to Secret Hurt, a domestic abuse forum? Harper's jaw dropped. He looked genuinely horrified.
I've never abused my wife.
I carried on as if he hadn't spoken. Classic tactic to get him riled. Riled equals talkative. She tried to hide her drinking from you, but you could always tell when she'd hit the bottle, couldn't you? The mess in your living room. The broken glass and upended furniture. There wasn't a struggle, was there? Sarah had just been on another bender. He didn't answer, but he didn't need to. His non-verbals spoke for him. Her addiction took its toll on you. You threw her booze away whenever you found it, but it didn't stop her. Her stuff, she'd called it. A euphemism, a way of avoiding having to face up to her problem. Same with the bulimia. You made her keep the bathroom door open when she went to the loo. You thought it'd stop her making herself puke. But it didn't, did it? She always found a way to purge. She thought you were punishing her, but you weren't. You were just trying to help. You've been doing that for a long time, haven't you, Dan? Looking out for your wife. He looked up. His mouth opened a crack. He wanted to talk, but the thinking part of his brain was stopping him. She hung out with a bad crowd at uni, druggies. They got her into LSD. You managed to get her away from them, though, I said, looking through the posts to suggest it was all there. You were her knight in shining armour. The only person she's ever been able to count on.
She said that.
His eyes were shiny, emotion taking over. I couldn't help feeling sorry for the guy. Aye, it's all here, I said. She talks about Noah, her eating disorder, everything. Even your affair with Yasmin. He flushed at the mention of Pejman. Were we there yet? The point when Harper had nothing to lose. Chapter 127. You knew she'd done something bad, didn't you? And the app you'd downloaded showed where she'd been. Harper's eyes widened. A cornered animal. That night, after you and your colleagues had been drinking, celebrating your deal, you came home and found Sarah covered in blood. She seemed confused, and there wasn't a mark on her. Nothing that could have accounted for all that blood. You didn't know straight away what she'd done, but you knew she hadn't been right since Noah and that her drinking was out of control. Things didn't look good, though it wasn't till you went into the office the next day that you connected the dots to Yasmin Pejman, the woman you'd been having an affair with.
No,
Harper kept whispering, covering his eyes and shaking his head, but unlike Tristan Fontaine, he wasn't banging his fists on the table, shouting that I'd got it wrong. You ran a bath for her, I said. Only you were freaking out. You'd been out drinking yourself. You weren't thinking straight. You didn't give the water time to warm up. You held her head down to wash her hair. You scrubbed her clean. Harper's mouth was hanging open. The guy must have thought I was a psychic. She wrote about it, I said, pointing out a paragraph in one of the forum posts. She wrote a lot about you, actually.
She's not well, he said.
He looked like he was about to cover the interview room in pavement pizza. She thought you were trying to wash the bad off her. She thought that's what she heard you say. But she got it wrong, though, didn't she? It wasn't the bad you were trying to get off her. It was the blood. She's filled with guilt and self-hate. She heard what she expected to hear. She thought you were talking about her. I paused, letting the dust settle. She suffers from dissociative fugues, I said. The big reveal. Harper's face didn't change. A good card player, waiting to see what I'd got in my hand before he placed his bet. It's a psychological disorder triggered by extreme stress, involving amnesia, which causes a person to lose touch with who they are, but apparently still function normally. I said, spelling it out. Your wife had no idea she'd stabbed someone, why she was covered in blood, or why you were holding her under the water. When she came round to find herself covered in scratches and you shouting at her, she assumed you'd attacked her. Only you knew the truth. The injuries were sustained during the attack on Yasmin Pejman. In knife homicides, it's almost impossible for offenders to avoid being scratched or getting the victim's blood on themselves. My guess is you got the blood on your shirt she talks about when you were cleaning her. Harper pursed his lips, a brief involuntary movement. That's a yes then, I thought. It was only later, when you found out Yasmin had been killed, that you began to realize the full extent of what had actually happened. The knife Sarah says you were going to return to the shop wasn't in the car where you told her you'd left it. You knew your wife had found out about your affair. She'd already confronted you, and you knew she'd been driving your car. You found blood in it. That's why you got it valeted. Perhaps you found something belonging to Yasmin, too. His face tensed. Another yes. You checked your GPS app. It confirmed your fears. No question, Sarah was in Clerkenwell and then at the crime scene the night of Pejman's murder, but you didn't dob her in. Instead, you looked out for her, just like you always have. You know the law, though. You knew what you'd done amounted to assisting an offender and perverting the course of justice. By now, you were as tied to this as she was. No way you'd be crawling out of the shit smelling of Purcell. All you could do was follow the investigation and keep tabs on her. Which is how I know you can help us find her. Because if there's one person who knows where she's hiding, it's you.
Chapter 128. It was time to talk turkey. Bake the bread while the oven is hot, my father would have said. An old Farsi expression. Or head down, arse up, to use one of Duncan's. You looked for the knife, I said, but you couldn't find it, and in the end you gave up searching. You never guessed your wife would kill a second time. You were so sure Pejman's murder was about your affair, it didn't occur to you the motive went deeper. How could you understand your wife was actually lashing out against women who represented the person she truly hated? Herself.
She's not well, he said again. Geez, he really loves that line, I thought. You said it yourself, he said, leaning forward. She suffers from psychogenic fugues.
She didn't know what she was doing.
But you did. You followed the investigation closely. You did your research on me after I spoke to the press. You even tried to feed us false information. The stress started to get to you, though. You became absent-minded. You couldn't think of anything else. Then Tristan Fontaine was arrested, and it looked like Sarah was in the clear. Which is why you got so wound up last night in your car when you found out we weren't discounting other suspects. Harper was a man with nowhere to run. But I wasn't feeling sympathetic. He'd have happily let Fontaine go to jail to save his and Sarah's necks. The good news is we no longer believe you killed Yasmin and Lily. The bad news is, time's up for you and your wife. Harper looked up from his hands. There was fight in his eyes.
In 1983, serial rapist Bob Millikan was declared insane and therefore not responsible for his crimes on the basis of his dissociative identity disorder. In 1990, the Crown versus Bartfield, the Court of Appeal overturned a manslaughter conviction on the same grounds.
I could use that. We know your wife's very sick. We also know more people will be hurt if she isn't apprehended soon. Tell me where we can find her before she kills again. Let us get her the help she needs. Dissociative fugues can be treated. She may never remember what she did when she was under, but with psychiatric input, she could be cured. That's what you want more than anything, isn't it? For her to be well? I paused, adjusting the dial on my scope. When you're going for the headshot, you need to line everything up just right. I realize you've been under intense pressure, and that although you broke the law, you did so for the best reasons. Another pause. This had to be about Harper now, not his wife. Carrot and stick. A judge isn't going to care why you did it, though. All they're going to see is that you aided and abetted a killer, and that if you'd come forward, Lily Abian would still be alive. We have someone from the Crown Prosecution Service standing by, ready to offer you a one-time offer if you help us find her. But you only have 5 minutes before it explodes. There are more than 20 detectives on this case, and every one of them's looking for a head to crack. They're not going to let me and you talk like this again. 5 minutes is all I've got to get a location out of you, and then the deal's off the table, and you get a bunk, courtesy of Her Majesty. Chapter 129. There's a look a man gets just before he breaks, a shadow that passes over his face. It was the look Dan Harper had now.
I only ever wanted to keep her safe, he said, his head bent. I can't believe she'd think I'd ever hurt her. There was always something so vulnerable about her, those big doe eyes and little bird body. The way she'd stretch the cuffs of her sweater over her hands. She was a perfect 8, but she always wore a 12. Everything was baggy on her. Made it look like she'd got lost in her clothes.
He wasn't exactly giving me map coordinates, but I let him talk. He was opening up. That was a start. I tried not to look at my watch or think what Sarah Harper might be doing with her next victim. It was early evening, but the woman was devolving. Just because she'd killed late at night before didn't mean she'd wait till then to strike again.
I remember the first time I saw her,
Dan said, looking into the middle distance.
She and her weird goth friends were handing out leaflets around the student union for some indie band. They were all dressed in black with army boots and thick eyeliner. They had the whole vampire thing going on. But Sarah was different. Even though she was dressed the same, she looked ethereal, like a will-o'-the-wisp. I took a leaflet. I hated Indy, but I wanted an excuse to talk to her. That night I went to the gig. It was worse than I'd thought, but at least we got to hang out. I bought her a cocktail. A chocolate frog. Actually, I bought her a few. And later I took her back to my bed.
Romance lives, I thought.
It wasn't sleazy, though, he said quickly, possibly catching my expression. We fell in love, told each other everything. We had so much in common.
He hesitated, as though he'd been about to say something he shouldn't.
She said she'd had a tough time growing up. Her parents adopted her after years of trying for a baby. Then a month after she moved in, her foster mother got pregnant. The way Sarah put it, she was kicked to the curb. No longer needed, now the longed-for child was on its way.
She was put back in care?
No, they kept her. Just didn't make her feel very loved. Nothing she ever did was good enough. A bit like...
He stopped again, looked down at his hands. How did she get on with her sibling?
Harper shrugged. She called him the golden child, GC.
They have much of a relationship now? He shook his head.
He was killed. It was hard on Sarah. The two of them had been playing hide-and-seek in the woods behind the house when he disappeared. The police found him buried under a pile of leaves, his head bashed in by a rock.
Crime of opportunity, I thought, and the concealment of the body suggests remorse and a relationship with the victim. The MO was different, but Sarah could have been responsible. After all, the absence of hesitation marks on Peshman's corpse did suggest the perp had killed before. Did they arrest anyone? Harper shook his head. When did Sarah come to London? If it was after her brother's murder, it'd suggest a habit of running away when the going got tough, and that might give us a clue about where she might be now.
When she was 18, she came here for uni, said she wanted to put an ocean between her and her parents. But some things you can't run from. The eating disorder and drinking had already been going on for ages by then.
He stopped, out of juice. But despite his outpouring, I was none the wiser about where his wife might be. Where's Sarah? I said, making a show of looking at my watch. Where would she go?
He rubbed his eyes, his head hung low. I want to cooperate. Ask me anything you want and I'll tell you, but I swear, I have absolutely no idea where she is. I've already spent half the night looking for her.
His hands were palm up on the table, his jaw loose. I didn't like his answer, but Dan Harper was telling the truth. Chapter 130. Stairwell, Scotland Yard, 1801. Harper hadn't told me where his wife was, but he had told me something else that would count in his favour.
I buried the clothes Sarah was wearing when she killed Yasmin and Lily, he said. They're in our back garden, under the apple tree.
It turned out he'd had to clean her up twice, though she hadn't come round from her blackout until after he'd undressed her the second time. That explains why she was naked when she came to, I thought. And why she talks about dirt on his trousers. It was mud. We'd soon have evidence that'd tie Sarah Harper to the homicides beyond all reasonable doubt. Now we just had to find her. My phone buzzed as I was making my way upstairs. My legs were stiff from sitting so long, I needed to stretch them out. I checked the screen. Wolfie. For the sixth time, given all the missed calls. Everything okay? I said, picking up.
Something's happened. I don't want you to overreact, but I thought you should know.
What? I said, adrenaline already pumping.
Seems my accident wasn't an accident at all. The police found a broken-off needle in the driver's side brake hole. Shows the brakes were tampered with. Someone made sure they'd fail. And they knew what they were doing, too. They'd worked to begin with, but after 20 minutes they'd become ineffective, which makes sense. I applied the brakes as I came off the Westway onto Marylebone Road, but the Range Rover wouldn't slow down. Someone was trying to kill me, Mac.
Hang up. Take your iPad into the bathroom and put the shower on. I'm going to Skype you right back. It's possible his mobile was being monitored, but internet calls can't be bugged. And even if a hostile had planted listening devices in his flat, they wouldn't hear our conversation over running water. A minute later, we were talking again. It was me who asked Plod to check